Blog Talk Radio.
Analytic and holistic approaches to fine art education, a comparative approach. Contents. 1.1. Cultures of learning. 2.2. Recursive cultural cognitive styles. 3.3. Convergence. 4.4. Complementarity. 5.5. Conclusion. 6. Notes on contributor. 7. References. Full text. After 4 years teaching in university fine art departments in Seoul and elsewhere in South Korea, I have discovered that pedagogic styles and methodologies, as well as expectations, are very different from those familiar to me from studying and teaching in my own country, the United Kingdom. Recognizing these deep differences has led me to question what I see as certain covertly universalizing tendencies within Western pedagogic conventions that conceal valuable differences, and this is what I address here. Following the social psychologist Richard E. Nisbet, I define these differences under the rubrics analytic, West, and holistic, East. I discuss how these different cognitive styles affect cultures of learning, and conclude that South Korean pedagogy in fine art has something to teach us in the West. A more flexible kind of pedagogic approach would be one that brings the insights of the East Asian culture of learning, which is grounded in intimate embodied meaning, social interdependence and holism, into contact with Western insights grounded in dualism, detached analysis and individual integrity and autonomy. As globalization draws once far distant peoples together, the differences between cultures of learning come into higher relief. From a Western perspective, one of the obvious repercussions of this cultural revolution for fine art education specifically, and in relation to the West and East Asia, which will be my focus, is the presence of East Asian students on fine art courses in the West. From an East Asian perspective, meanwhile, it means the presence within academic cadres of these former Western-educated students, who are now professors, and have usually been educated at master's level, and increasingly up to PhD level. But another significant consequence is the presence of Westerners teaching in English in Asia, as in my own case. Does this new situation produce a melting pot of diverse cultures of learning, one in which some kind of synchronization, Smith and Hu, 20, occurs, or middle ground, Ma, 11, emerges? Is a metaculture of learning on the horizon? Or is the situation one in which an awkward mismatch between cultures of learning causes confusion and misunderstanding, and produces deficient pedagogic styles, and ill-prepared graduates? South Korea is an especially interesting case in point, as it is widely acknowledged that education is one of the most significant contributing factors to the nation's economic success story. As a result, its system is eagerly observed as a role model. However, at the same time, one of the most frequent criticisms leveled at South Korean students studying fine art in the West is that they lack the basic study skills required to succeed, Cousins opening square bracket 2, McCool and Morley, 12. There is, of course, a complex and specific historical context to address, which means that the evolution of fine art departments within South Korean universities has taken an inevitably specific form. But I will focus only on broader differences within cultures of learning, addressing this problematic issue from the perspective of a British teacher of fine art who is now teaching in South Korea. I will also draw on my experience as an artist, an activity that has made me acutely aware of the complex relationship between theory and practice, and as an art historian interested in non-Western art. I use a very broad brush. I generalized by presenting for consideration two cultural orientations, West and East Asian, and explore how these orientations have developed contrasting approaches to teaching fine art. 1. Cultures of learning. Western fine art pedagogy hopes to distinguish itself from other more strictly academic disciplines where standardized testing prevails, and deductive reasoning dominates other kinds of cognitive processes by encouraging creative, imaginative, divergent, or lateral thinking skills. But at the same time, these fine art departments have become increasingly assimilated into the wider academic infrastructure, and as a result find themselves obliged to adopt the kinds of pedagogic goals already established within more overtly intellectual fields where the cognitive style is logical, objective, intellectual, realistic, planned, discriminatory, structured, and quantitative. We can generalize by saying that within the humanities and Western academia, the standard pedagogic requirement is that students acquire the ability to verbally articulate a problem or question, and then come to a reason, linear and unambiguous conclusion. This intellectual activity is understood to be based on the possession and mastery of prior knowledge within an appropriate field, filtered through introspection and critical analysis. This style of education is especially geared towards encouraging metacognitive learning strategies, or how to apply thinking about thinking, which means students must monitor their own learning and develop a broader picture within which to understand their studies. Western fine art education at university level has also come to value as part and parcel of its culture of learning its students' ability to clearly articulate and sustain discursive expositions. The UK's CAS subject benchmark statements emphasize that a key goal in fine art should be teaching students to analyze information and experiences, formulate independent judgments, and articulate reasoned arguments through reflection, review and evaluation. Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education, UK, 16, 4.4.2. As a result, students are supposed to possess the ability to formulate reasoned responses to the critical judgments of others, and to identify personal strengths and needs, 4.4.2. Consequently, we can say that in the Western fine art culture of learning, the ability to conceptualize and articulate thoughts in the medium of words is considered not simply a supplement to successful manual work done in the studio, but its prerequisite. Critical thinking skills are prioritized in CRITs, for example, where students hone their ability to analyze, judge, focus, converge, objectify, reason, and draw clear conclusions through presentations of their work to fellow students and one or more professors and/or visiting artists or critics. Furthermore, while the final year degree show, in which students present a body of work, is considered a crucial aspect of this culture of learning, it is supplemented by other kinds of evaluated outcome, such as essays, texts and reflective journals or reports. The underlying dynamics of knowledge and understanding in fine art education can be addressed according to three categories: cognitive, mental skills, affective, feeling or emotional skills and attitudes, and psychomotor, manual or physical skills. Western art education is increasingly preoccupied with assessing thinking within the cognitive category and neglects the other two. It has shifted pedagogic attention away from process-based manual and physical skills and onto the ideas and concepts informing these material outcomes. The teaching of manual, psychomotor skills through the use of various techniques or the acquisition of established styles and skills is neglected. Our culture of learning now also downplays or neglects the role of secondary sensible properties in art making, those properties more closely connected with the somatic, effective, emotional, and valuing tone of experience and attitudes. We prioritize primary intellectual properties associated with the higher cognitive skills. In contrast, within the South Korean culture of learning in general, the kinds of analytic and problem-solving approaches backed by hypothesis-evidence-conclusion-style rhetoric that are typical in the West are less important than the values of compliance, discipline and conformity, learning by rote, and conforming to hierarchies of knowledge and authority. Standardized testing is the dominant pedagogic tool. This is a culture of learning interested in tangible results, a goal-oriented approach to teaching. But at the same time, a close and intimate relationship is promoted between student and teacher, based on the deep-rooted Confucian belief in teaching by example. As Judith Smith and Ran Ho, 2088, write, this means that students follow teachers' instructions without question, value actions and attitudes that affect their future, and are persistent and hard-working. The Eastern culture instills in teachers the responsibility of not only teaching knowledge toward a particular subject, but also to educate students to become people of virtue. In relation to the teaching of fine art, significant differences to the West therefore exist. In the West, the presentation of a portfolio of work by a student is a mandatory entrance requirement for study at BA level, but in South Korea it is usual for students to sit an entrance examination involving timed drawing and painting tasks. This means that psychomotor skills are the focus of attention from even before a student begins undergraduate studies. Within fine art courses, less attention is paid to the development and deployment of an overarching pedagogic methodology embodied in a curriculum. There seems to be little intrinsic value attributed to a clearly defined pedagogic structure that organizes planned instructional content, materials, resources, and processes for evaluation. Instead, however, great emphasis is placed on the personal relationship that develops between student and teacher. The teacher exercises considerable influence over his or her charges, influence that often extends to students feeling compelled to emulate their teacher's own artistic style or conform to their tastes. Compared to the artworks produced by UK students, those of Korean BA and MA students are often of a remarkably high standard in terms of technical skill. But there is none of the discursively rendered evidence of how students get there, as there would be in the West. In particular, critical awareness of the relationship of students' work to other artists, both historical and contemporary, is not articulated critically or reflectively. Such relationships are only present within the works themselves, as embodied evidence. At MA and PhD level, the story is somewhat different, as a more concerted attempt is made to encourage reflective criticality, and as in the West, this involves classes in theory and the writing of a dissertation. However, in my experience, Korean master's and PhD students' ability to analyze and contextualize their knowledge and to apply critical frameworks is very limited compared to Western students. In general, then, the South Korean culture of learning does not seem to value the incorporation into the classroom context and evaluation process of evidence of independent study and thought that might entail critical and reflexive approaches to their work and to the organization of knowledge in general. There is only a minor requirement for students to make available for discussion and evaluation some kind of paper trail, that is, accessible traces or records of the thought processes that have gone into the making of finished works. Process learning, the ability to learn through a series of actions, changes or functions, trumps other kinds of learning, but this too is not recorded in any other way than within the finished works themselves. Divergent cycles of the learning processes certainly occur, but they happen in private. Divergent thinking, which contrasts with convergent thinking, necessitates phases of critical thinking. It is based on a willingness to attempt multiple solutions to any given problem, and involves the recognition that unsuccessful solutions are also important to the thinking process. Western fine art education seeks to catch such divergent thoughts and actions within its pedagogic net, making it available for sharing and evaluation, but in South Korea this style of learning occurs below the radar. What is recorded are the convergent thoughts embodied in the finished work of art. Independent, critical, open-ended, ludic conceptualizations of the thinking process are not shared or recorded discursively, and therefore they are not available for discursive discussion or evaluation. As a result of this style of pedagogy, we can say that teaching in South Korea tends to be successful in encouraging and evaluating a student's affective and psychomotor skills. But to Westerners, its pedagogy seems cognitively impoverished. And yet it is obviously wrong to say that Korean students are thought less. The problem for Westerners is that by our standards the ways in which they think seem overly lateralized, associative, diffuse, and visually oriented. Korean students show a great ability to visually articulate concepts and ideas through work rather than merely in relation to it, and this means that thought processes are internal to the artwork rather than external to it. But these non-conceptual forms of thinking and knowing are difficult for Westerners to value. They are seen to involve a kind of dark or esoteric thinking. It is in relation to exactly these cognitive qualities that Western fine art educational protocols are insensitive. In particular, in our Western culture of learning, we fail to adequately integrate psychomotor and affective skills into some kind of functional and productive relationship with cognitive skills. The psychologist Howard Gardner, (5), proposes that there are 7 kinds of intelligence: logical, mathematical, linguistic, spatial, musical, bodily, kinesthetic, interpersonal, and intrapersonal. Gardner concludes that these usually operate together, but modern, westernized technological society has biased cognitive skills towards the first two and neglected the others, with disastrous results. This is due to a deep-rooted cognitive bias that sets up a dualism between mind on the one side, and affect and body on the other. In relation to fine art, this bias is especially constraining. Thus, for example, as the philosopher Mark Johnson (7, 234) stresses, the obvious fact that we usually cannot put into words what we have experienced in our encounter with an artwork does not make the embodied, perceptual meaning any less a type of meaning. It can be argued that the Korean culture of learning and fine art seeks to engage the spatial and bodily kinesthetic intelligences to a greater extent than the Western culture of learning. 2. Recursive cultural cognitive styles. The differences in cultures of learning sketched above thus point to different and deeply recursive orientations towards the world. The mind is an active agent in relation to how it perceives and interacts with the world, and the self creates reality just as much as it perceives reality. So what we experience is not the actual world but rather a recreation, an interactive experience of the world that is the result of the conditioning of the culture in which we live. It is possible to become so locked into seeing something in one particular way that we will not be able to see any other pattern, or acknowledge the validity of another point of view. But the value of any body of knowledge is limited to the paradigm, or gestalt, that produces it. As Maurice Merleau-Ponty, (13, 18), writes, a horizon of meaning structures and delimits consciousness. This horizon surrounds each situation, and is the limitation placed on change. It is what allows us to adopt a perspective, but it is also what prohibits us from being open to alternatives. As a consequence, as the philosopher Thomas Kasulis writes in Intimacy or Integrity (8, 22), a study of Western and East Asian concepts of being, in one culture certain experiences are considered the most interesting for analysis, the most revealing of our basic humanity, the most fruitful to emphasize, while in another they might be considered common, not particularly revealing about very much. The research of social psychologist Stephen Hine demonstrates how concepts of selfhood are determined by interactions with the cultural environment and ossify into recursive cultural orientations. He describes an East Asian cultural bias towards what he calls the interdependent self, where individuals are understood to be connected to each other via a network of relationships. This Hine contrasts to the Western model of the autonomous self, where selfhood is generated in contrast to others. As Hine (6, 896) notes, in general, across a wide variety of paradigms, there is converging evidence that East Asians view in-group members as an extension of their selves while maintaining distance from out-group members. North Americans show a tendency to view themselves as distinct from all other selves, regardless of their relationships to the individual. The individualistic West confronts the collectivist East, and as Hine (6, 885) writes, the resultant self-concept that will emerge from participating in highly individualized North American culture will differ importantly from the self-concept that results from the participation in the Confucian interdependence of East Asian culture. Thomas Kasulis utilizes the terms integrity, West, and intimacy, East Asian, to distinguish these same cultural differences on an ontological level, while in the geography of thought, 15. The social psychologist Richard E. Nisbet employs the terms analytic, West, and holistic, East Asian, in order to contrast them on the level of cognitive style. In the Western paradigm, Nisbet writes, consciousness is construed as non-corporeal, detached and autonomous. For Westerners, it is the self who does the acting. For Easterners, action is something that is undertaken in concert with others or that is the consequence of the self operating in a field of forces. 15, 158. as Nisbet continues, to the Asian the world is a complex place composed of continuous substances, understood in terms of the whole rather than in terms of the parts, and subject more to collective than to personal control. Meanwhile, the Westerner, the world is a relatively simple place, composed of discrete objects that can be understood without undue attention to context, and highly subject to personal control. 100. Analytic thought, Nisbet writes, follows patterns organized through visual segregation by dissecting the world into a limited number of discrete objects having particular attributes that can be categorized in clear ways. He details research that shows that Japanese participants in experiments are more attentive to the whole perceptual field, that is, to the figure-ground continuum, than American participants, who are more drawn to individual foci of attention. This divergence is also paralleled in the structure of language. East Asian languages are highly contextual, words typically have multiple meanings, and the absence of personal pronouns in the Korean language, for example, adds to its inherent ambiguity, and foregrounds the role played by context in determining meaning. Western languages, in contrast, are more context-free and preoccupied with focal objects as opposed to context. Analytic thought credits the rewards garnered from an ability to provide clear, detached, distinct, abstract, rational, objective information. Its epistemology thus promotes an either/slash or binary model. As a result, it focuses on what lends itself to being captured in language, Nisbet, 15, 157. In contrast, holistic thought, Nisbet writes, responds to a much wider array of objects and their relations, and, makes fewer sharp distinctions among attributes or categories, and so, is less well suited to linguistic representation, 15, 211. Awareness of process predominates over the search for essences or fixed and finite forms. It thus presents itself as non-binary, promoting a both-or an approach to problem-solving. In this worldview there is an intrinsic overlap between self and world, so that the position of the perceiver and the maker, in relation to what is perceived and made, is not considered external. Instead, it is internal. One way of observing these different worldviews at work is to think about how mind, the part of the self that thinks, reasons, feels, and remembers, is conceptualized within models of consciousness. Most Westerners will point to their cerebrum when asked to locate the physical location of this elusive entity, while most East Asians will point to the region of their heart. Etymologically, the meanings of the English word mind cluster around the act of remembering and memory, while the French word esprit suggests another etymology that brings meaning closer to spirit, energy or liveliness. But since Descartes introduced his influential dualistic interpretation of consciousness, upon which modern rational thought was established, mind has been opposed to body, which explains why Westerners point where they do. In contrast, the Chinese written character translated into English as mind is composed from the ideogram for heart, for since ancient times the heart was understood to be its location, and so the two are interchangeable and inextricable. Both concepts of mind are congruent with the contrasting analytic or integral and holistic or intimate worldviews from which they arise. In the former, the self is detached from a world that is viewed as static and compartmentalized, while in the latter, the self is corporeally immersed in the flow of life. The clear benefits to be gained from both paradigms explain their cultural recursiveness. The Western model has the following broad characteristics: it fosters an intellectual attitude, preoccupied with mental activity and values, differentiating intellect and psychology from the somatic dimension. Emphasis is placed on analytic thought, which means experiences are processed by being abstracted and divided into elemental parts or basic principles. The discursive mode of thinking is valued, in which thoughts proceed to a conclusion through deductive logic, reasoning and objective analysis rather than emotion and intuition, promoting a cognitive style uninfluenced by personal feelings or opinions when considering and representing facts. It thereby ensures grounds for publicly verifiable objective facts freed from affect. This worldview fosters self-consciousness and reflectiveness, and generates the idea of a transcendent realm of pure forms or non-material entities, of a god who is separated from the natural world. The East Asian worldview, on the other hand, offers the self a greater sense of being united with a transpersonal whole. It fosters awareness of complementarity and intimate connectedness. Furthermore, it is somatically oriented, seeing the self as immersed in a living, bodily and participatory context. Ontologically, there is the notion that the self exists in the midst of things rather than externally. More attention is paid to effect, to pathos as well as logos, as a component of knowledge, and this leads to the acknowledgement of the value of nonverbal understanding. Some important knowledge is construed as essentially esoteric or dark, rather than bright and clear. Epistemologically, this means non-duality or monism. Distinctions between subjective and objective therefore have little value. Metaphysically, it fosters the idea of an immanent spirituality, occurring in the here and now. One detrimental consequence of the Western recursive paradigms is that when thinking, Westerners tend to be uncomfortable. We overvalue an ability to present clear, distinct, rational, objective, and analytical ideas through the medium of verbal language, believing that if we put our thoughts and feelings into words, we are in control. Furthermore, failure to realize these criteria signifies lack and loss of mastery. The atomization of selfhood into individualistic autonomous units isolates the self from the wider community, fostering potential antagonism between the interests of the self and the social realm. Because of the East Asian bias, meanwhile, the self within this cultural matrix tends to be uncomfortable with the analytically cognitive and with abstractions. As a result, there is an absence of individual, reflective, effect-free critical thought. Because much cognition is understood to happen beyond the scope of language, within the discursive domain there is a tendency to depend on shared tacit knowledge that remains unchallenged and under-articulated subjectively. This means a proclivity towards reliance on the consensus view and shared viewpoint, rather than on individualized and potentially dissenting expression, Kasuli's opening square bracket 8, 132. In relation to fine art in particular, the Western paradigm provides grounds for mediating the artist as someone separated from the world. It thereby fosters a sense of artistic autonomy, the idea that art is a subjective addition to the world. And in contrast to the objectivity fostered in other epistemological fields, this has the effect of encouraging the subjective element in artistic consciousness, and the idea of individual freedom of expression, Kasuli's opening square bracket 8, 132. However, in contrast, when it comes to assessing the meaning of works of art, such dualism leads to discursively intellectual and detached properties of thought prevailing over emotion and subjective response. An artwork is separated into discrete, structural parts, and the goal is to identify content as something distinct from style. In the East Asian paradigm, meanwhile, an attitude is fostered that sees art as expressing an intrinsic overlap between the self and the world of others, and creativity is understood to arise from this interaction, Kasuli's opening square bracket 8, 132. Non-conceptual, visual and practical thinking is valued, and is considered fundamentally concrete. It exists in relation to a material or physical form. This kind of aesthetic attitude is involved in processes of knowing that cannot be separated out into elemental parts, and then reorganized into new wholes. The thoughts expressed within a work of art are the result of responding to materials and processes of making rather than of abstracting and organizing thoughts that exist anterior and exterior to the work itself. When confronted with a work of art, this way of experiencing and interpreting does not see a collection of discrete parts that can be divided up. There is no division between style and content. Thus, the East Asian worldview fosters a greater sense of unity between theory and practice, style and content, through the assertion that practice is theory in action, or style is the performance of content. The limitations inherent in these different orientations can also be seen played out within their cultures of learning, especially in relation to the intrinsically manual and visual activity of fine art. Western fine art pedagogy seeks to incorporate into the curriculum strategies that supply students with the kinds of multitasking and transferable skills, and technological know-how increasingly required to function within contemporary society. However, in its quest to engage with a wider vision of fine art and its role in society, this culture of learning risks failing to equip graduates with any skills in particular. In contrast, South Korean fine art teaching is still very much focused on teaching mastery of single-task skills within the traditional disciplines. More profoundly, Western fine art pedagogy applies a dualistic approach in which concepts, as part of thought, are pitted against feelings and imagination, which are tied to the body. As Mark Johnson (7, 216) puts it, the Western paradigm aligns meaning with the cognitive and thus dismisses quality, feeling, and emotion from any account of meaning, italics in the original. As he emphasizes, this is especially debilitating in relation to the domain of art, where it is images, patterns, qualities, colors, and perceptual rhythms that are the principal bearer of meaning, 216. There is therefore always a risk of disjunction between theory and practice, of being able to account for what Johnson (7, 234) calls embodied, immanent meaning. Underlying this is a problem in linking making and thinking, crafting and knowing, and in adequately interpreting how raw things are transformed into stable and ordered forms through the imagination mixed with bodily actions. As a consequence, writes the communication theorist John Schotter, 19, 192, in the arts, we seek the contents supposed to be hidden in the forms before us, by offering interpretations to represent this content. In short, we formulate the circumstances in question as a problem requiring a solution or explanation that those, sitting in classrooms or seminar rooms, can see or picture as matching or as fitting the facts. Within South Korean fine art pedagogy, on the other hand, there is disregard for the role of cognitive skills in relation to affective and motor skills. This is because of the absence of the dualism that dominates the Western paradigm. Less epistemological value is attributed to the ability to stand back and analyze thought processes into clear, distinct, linear patterns. Furthermore, making translations between the discursive and the manual is problematic because this paradigm cannot see the sense in articulating the one within the space of the other. It does not recognize inherent merit in reflective criticality and the use of metacognitive strategies. Research undertaken by Richard E. Nisbet gives practical demonstrations of how such cultural differences play out in relation to educational methodologies when the holistic mind finds itself stranded within an analytic context, the Western classroom, for example. Nisbet describes an experiment designed to test the possibility that East Asians find it relatively difficult to use language to represent thought. Kim, the Korean psychologist in charge of the test, had people speak out loud as they solved various kinds of problems, Nisbet writes. This had no effect on the performance of European Americans. But the requirement to speak out loud had very deleterious effects on the performance of Asians and Asian Americans. 211. Thus, when East Asians are transported into the orbit of the Western culture of learning, they seem to Westerners to be cognitively deficient. But as a consequence of the research he has conducted, Nisbet, 15, 212, is compelled to ask, how should one educate Asians and Asian Americans in American classrooms? Is it a form of colonialism to demand that they perform verbally and share their thoughts with their classmates? Would it have the effect of undermining the skills that go with a holistic approach to the world? Or is it merely common sense to prepare them for a world in which verbal presentation skills, even if it might be difficult to achieve them, will come in handy? 3. Convergence. Over the past century, both the traditional Eastern and Western worldviews have been challenged from within and without. One obvious consequence of these challenges is that concepts of mind have undergone significant transformations. In the West, we have begun once more to incorporate the body into a general picture of consciousness. As Merleau-Ponty argued, for example, the self must be understood as connected to the world by a web of interrelated embodied sensations, for the body is involved in a multisensorial dialogue with the world. What Merleau-Ponty, 14, called it his later work The Flesh of the World. This sense of rooted being in the world, he argued, means deep pre-reflective involvement with our surroundings, prior to any concepts or reflection, and so there is an indivisibility of seer and seen, a densely woven fabric of experience in which body and things are linked and are no longer ontological opposites. As the art historian James Elkins (opening square bracket 4, 1) writes, Western approaches to art now recognize that seeing is embodied, and it should no longer be separated from touching, feeling, and from the full range of somatic response. To a large extent, such thought has shifted hand in hand with transformations in contemporary art. Synesthesia, Einfühlung, empathy, and sympathy, immersion, performance, and embodied encounters are now central to the art experience, writes Elkins (opening square bracket 4, 1). It is recognized that art is involved in eliciting feelings, emotions, intuitions, sensations, and affects, as well as functioning as a discursive semiotic code. Even the most abstract and intellectual activities are affected by drives or energy, and so primary intellectual properties take their place beside secondary sensible properties, those more closely connected with the somatic, emotional and valuing tone of experience and attitudes rather than knowledge. Thus, for example, as part of a broader strategy to recast the interpretation of art as something experienced as sensation, Gilles Deleuze (opening square bracket 3) argues that art's power lies in its ability to create affects independent of content or meaning. It exposes the viewer to an impersonal, differential flow of life that is felt rather than understood or comprehended. This idea of the embodiment of mind is something long familiar to the East Asian worldview. But here there has been a shift in the opposite direction. Aspects of Western-style dualism now undergird East Asian societies which are set on the goals achieved through applying the algorithms of instrumental reason. East Asians are learning to consider that words are the proper and most valuable bearers of meaning. They learn to think in terms of an individualized subjective self who is opposed to an inert objective world, to analyze and organize, to downplay meanings that are non-cognitive and embodied, and to consider valid knowledge to be something exclusively objective. The influential British educationalist Ken Robinson, 1718, argues that the arts are crucial for the success of this new task because ideally they serve as domains within which the aesthetic experience can be explored, encouraging all the senses to operate at their peak. But instead, in Robinson's opinion, our cultures of learning mostly have the opposite effect. They offer an anesthetic experience that deadens students to the wider spectrum of consciousness, and fails to prepare them for participation in our complex digital world. In this context, fine art education at university level should be playing a major role in preparing students to be creative and integrated citizens of the 21st century. It should be serving as a role model for other academic disciplines, rather than being obliged to conform to standardized criteria grounded in the instrumentalist goals of academia as a whole. 4. Complementarity. The famous ambiguous figure of an old woman or young woman reveals cognitive styles at work on a perceptual level, and how they directly connect to the ways in which meaning are constructed. In the Western worldview, based on the analytic mind, it is necessary to distinguish each gestalt, and to prioritize one of them, it is either a young woman or an old woman. Dualism prevails. To accept the equal validity of both is to fall into a paradoxical contradiction. But in the East Asian worldview, as Kasulis (opening square bracket 8, 158) writes, the challenge posed to cognitive mastery by such ambiguity would be articulated as presenting the viewer with a gestalt picture that can be either old woman or young woman, but which I am going to discuss here as old woman, or b, a gestalt picture that can be either old woman or young woman, but which I am going to discuss here as a young woman. That is, the analysis would not begin from poles of intimacy or integrity, rather, the two would emerge out of their overlapping in medias res. As with yin and yang, one pole could never exist independently of the other. The balance between the two would contextually shift so that one would sometimes predominate over the other but at other times would be subordinate. We thereby enter a kind of metagestalt, aware that nothing in its environment has changed, as Thomas Kuhn, 10, 114, writes in relation to another ambiguous figure, the duck rabbit. Someone directs his attention increasingly not to the figure, duck or rabbit, but to the lines of the paper he is looking at. Ultimately, he may even learn to see those lines without seeing either of the figures, and he may then say, what he could not legitimately have said earlier, that it is these lines that he really sees, but that he sees them alternately as a duck and as a rabbit. Metastability is one way of describing the benefits of an ability to shift between gestalts. In the complementary mind opening parenthesis opening square bracket 9, the neuroscientists J.A. Scott Kelso and David Engstrom discuss how it is now recognized that, contrary to classical Western assumptions concerning logic, complementariness lies at the center of many important cognitive processes. They propose the use of the grapheme tilde or squiggle opening parenthesis closing parenthesis as the symbol for a way of thinking that prioritizes the equivalent or complementary relation as opposed to the contrary, dual or oppositional. The squiggle is not merely oneness as opposed to multiplicity, it implies non-duality rather than uniformity or synthesis. They thereby hope to lay the ground for a mode of analysis that reconciles such apparent contradictions, dualisms and binary oppositions. As Kelso and Engstrom opening parenthesis opening square bracket 9, write. Metastability, by reducing the strong hierarchical coupling between the parts of a complex system while allowing them to retain their individuality, leads to a looser, more secure, more flexible form of functioning that promotes the creation of information. Too much autonomy of the component parts means no chance of their coordinating and communicating together. On the other hand, too much interdependence, and the system gets stuck, global flexibility is lost. Metastable complementarity is intrinsic to the East Asian paradigm. The Western analytic paradigm resists the metacognitive stance in relation to worldviews. It must make a choice and create binary oppositions. While the Western model can only see a choice from the exterior point of view, from a condition of duality, the East Asian holistic model inhabits complementarity from within. 5. Conclusion. As Smith and Hu, 20, 89-90, write in relation to broad teaching goals, and with the American model specifically in mind. Prior to the year 2000, the emphasis for educating students was to promote the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. Today, in the 21st century, educators have a new charge: teach the new three R's: rigor, relevance, and real-world skills. Educators agree with business leaders and other interested groups that specific skills are needed for students to succeed in life in the 21st century of global communication, social networking, and a world of new technologies. Within the multiple meeting places characteristic of contemporary global culture, differences vie with the forces of homogeneity. But in his seminal The Location of Culture opening parenthesis opening square bracket 1, Homi Bhabha argued that previously autonomous cultural orientations are now contested both from within and without, and creativity lies within the obscure and fluid realm of hybridity where cultures meet and merge, displacing meaning to the indeterminate liminal zone of the culturally in between, to the interstices, the overlap and displacement domains of difference, where the intersubjective and collective experiences of nationness, community interest, or cultural value are negotiated. Bhabha opening square bracket 1, 2. The broad context for my discussion, therefore, is not so much irreconcilable cultural difference or some clash of civilizations as a situation within which worldviews are becoming more permeable to each other. Ultimately, the value of making the kind of cross-cultural comparison I have attempted will lie how it looks at where ideas overlap and meet, but also where such meetings cease, and trying to understand why. Fine art education is caught between, on the one hand, the need to conform to wider academic criteria and, on the other, remaining true to intrinsic aesthetic criteria that set it apart from other disciplines. The imperatives of the intellectualized academic approach vie awkwardly with the needs and skills generated by affective and psychomotor activity. The Western culture of learning values orderly, systematized and divisive processes, and downplays the non-cognitive, somatic, performative, and participatory, the realm of expressive bodily movements and changes that the East Asian culture of learning and fine art better understands. A stronger, that is, more flexible, kind of pedagogic approach would be one that brings the insights of the East Asian culture of learning grounded in intimate embodied meaning, social interdependence and holism, into contact with Western insights grounded in dualism, detached analysis and individual integrity and autonomy. As Nisbet, 15, 212, observes, two advantages of East Asian cognitive skills stand out, opening parenthesis 1, the fact that Asians see more of a given scene or context than Westerners do, and opening parenthesis 2, the holistic, dialectic, middle way approach to problem solving. Nisbet believes the first is something that can be taught within a Western context. However, he is less sure whether the second is open to pedagogic attention, because it is so deeply rooted in a fundamentally different worldview. But fine art departments, East and West, could be spearheads for a hybrid analytic holistic metastable culture of learning that returns the aesthetic experience to the heart of education, an experience that is intrinsically more attuned to the cognitive skills Nisbet pinpoints as an inherent aspect of the East Asian worldview. This would lead to a metaculture of learning that brings cognitively structured, critical, reflective thinking and independent and active learning together with a less cognitively structured and more object-oriented approach, directed towards the perfection not only of the cognitive but also of the affective and psychomotor skills. Notes on Contributor. Simon Morley is an artist and writer, and teaches fine art at Dankook University, South Korea. He has recently had solo exhibitions in London, Paris and Seoul. His artist's website is www.simonmorley.com. He has published in a number of journals, including Third Text and JVAP, and is the author of Writing on the Wall, Words and Image in Modern Art, Thames and Hudson / California University Press, 2003, and editor of The Sublime, Documents in Contemporary Art, Whitechapel / MIT Press, 2010. He is the co-author of the recently published The Winchester Guide to Keywords and Concepts for International Students in Art, Media and Design, Wiley, 2014. His academic website is https://dankook.academia.edu/Simon Morley. References. 1. Baba, Homi, 1994. The Location of Culture. London, Routledge. 2. Cousins, John. 2008. Situating Korean Fine Art Practice in a Western Context. CLIP/CETL Pedagogic Research Project Final Report. http://instituteformodern.co.uk/wp-content/upload/2011/11/situating-korean-fine-art.pdf. 3 Deleuze, Gilles. 2003. Francis Bacon. The Logic of Sensation. Translated by Daniel W. Smith. London. Continuum. 4 Elkins, James, editor, 2008. Art History versus Aesthetics, Art Seminar Series. London and New York, Routledge. 5 Gardner, Howard. 1983. Frames of Mind. The Theory of Multiple Intelligences. New York. Basic Books. 6 Hine, Stephen J. 2001. Self as Cultural Product. An Examination of East Asian and North American Selves. Journal of Personality 69, 6, 881-906. http://www.site.ubc.ca/ampersand/8764hine/docs/2001asianself.pdf. 7 Johnson, Mark. 2007. The Meaning of the Body. Aesthetics of Human Understanding. Chicago and London. University of Chicago Press. 8 Casulas, Thomas P. 2002. Intimacy or Integrity? Philosophy and Cultural Difference. Honolulu, Hawaii. University of Hawaii Press. 9 Kelso, J.A. Scott and David A. Engstrom. 2008. The Complementary Mind. Boston and New York, MIT Press. Kuhn, Thomas. 1962-1996. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. 3rd edition, Chicago and London. University of Chicago Press. Na, Wen, 2014. East Meets West in Teacher Preparation. Crossing Chinese and American Borders. New York. Teachers College Press. McCool, Annie Liu, and Simon Morley. 2014. Winchester Guide to Keywords and Concepts for International Students in Art, Media and Design. Marden, Massachusetts, Wiley Blackwell. Merleau-Ponty, Maurice. 1945-1962. The Phenomenology of Perception. Translated by Colin Smith. London, Routledge and Keegan Paul. Merleau-Ponty, Maurice. 1968. The Visible and the Invisible. Translated by Alfonso Lingus. Evanston. Northwestern University Press. Nisbet, Richard E. 2003. The Geography of Thought. How Asians and Westerners Think Differently, and Why. New York. Free Press. Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education, UK. 2008. Information and Guidance, Subject Benchmark Statement. Art and Design. http://www.cos.ac.uk/n/publication/document/subject-benchmark-statement-art-and-design-.pdf. Robinson, Ken. 1982. The Arts and Schools. Lisbon. Gallus de Gulbenkian Foundation. Robinson, Ken. 2001. Out of Our Minds. Learning to be Creative. Hoboken, New Jersey, Wiley. Schotter, John. 2008. Conversational Realities Revisited. Life, Language, Body, and World. Chagrin Falls, O. Taos Institute. Smith, Judith, and Ranhu. 2013. Rethinking Teacher Education. Synchronizing Eastern and Western Views of Teaching and Learning to Promote 21st Century Skills and Global Perspectives. Education Research and Perspectives 40, 86-108. http://www.urjournal.net/wp-content/upload/20103/04/erpv40%5ffinal%5fsmith-and-rude%5f2013%5fdash-rethinking-teacher-education.pdf. ////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////////// Copyright of Journal of Visual Art Practice is the property of Taylor & Francis Limited, and its content may not be copied or emailed to multiple sites or posted to a listserv without the copyright holder's express written permission. However, users may print, download, or email articles for individual use.
Mm-hmm.